Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Alexandra Spieldock, the Director of the Trade and Global Governance Program at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Alexandra specializes in analysis of international policy and institutions that support fairer rules in food and agriculture. She's been engaged in the World Trade Organization and regional trade advocacy since 1999, and has published various research and popular education materials on food security and global governance from a human rights and developmental perspective. Alexandra studied at the University of Buenos Aires in Argentina, as well as the University of Caen in Normandy, France. She also received an MA in international policy from the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Alexandra, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you so much.
So, where were you born, Alexandra? Give us a little bit of your background.
Well, I was born in the state of Missouri in St. Louis, and lived there for most of my childhood, and then at around 18, moved on, and I've sort of lived in a bunch of different places since that time, and you've mentioned a list of them, and just have been really inspired by this sort of moment in international development and this moment in the world where there's just a lot to try to understand and to shift, in my view. So that's my background.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating that you have lived in many countries and absorbed their culture and their politics, I'm sure. But when I read your recent article, I must say, on the land grab that's happening around the world by various other countries and huge corporations, I was absolutely flabbergasted. It really took my breath away. And so let's talk about the land grab. And your article is called Global Land Grab, and it was published in Foreign Policy in Focus in the year 2009, on June the 21st, which is very recent. Can you just give us a summary of where the world stands in terms of food and water and the population in the world today and what is predicted by 2050? I know that's a huge order to ask you, but could you sort of summarize a bit of it for us, Alexandra?
Well, sure. Where we are today is that we're in an incredible and historic food crisis. We now have over 1 billion people worldwide who are living with hunger. And this number has increased by more than 100 million people since 2006 alone. And it just represents a major setback in efforts to have or ultimately to eradicate hunger. So it's quite serious, the food crisis and all of the uncertainty that goes along with that. But we're also facing a variety of other crises, and land degradation is one major problem within that, as well as scarcity of water. It's projected that as many as 1.8 billion people will live in regions facing absolute water scarcity by 2025, and that two-thirds of the world's population could be struggling from water stress if we don't do something about it. So we are in a very particular and dire situation in many ways. The climate changes and with global warming and some of the increased difficulties isn't a strong enough word, but challenges that come with drought versus floods are also impacting food production and food availability and ultimately stability for populations. And these are all of the things that we have to contend with as we kind of try to understand what's at stake in this global crisis, as well as what are some of the solutions and policy shifts that need to happen.
Okay, so why was there an acute food crisis in 2006 and on? What actually happened, Alexandra?
Well, there were a variety of different things that happened. I would say there was a short-term food price crisis.
Why?
Which really reared its head in 2006. And the short-term reasons for that include financial speculation, particularly of commodities and global markets. Also, this incredible demand for biofuels that increased the price of commodities. We also saw some drought, as for instance in Australia, that impacted stocks. And so we saw, this moment in history with very low stocks. And food stocks in the world, and then ultimately the higher prices that went along with that. The longer-term reasons for the food crisis itself that really will take some time to flesh out and to resolve have to do with 30 years or so of deregulation and deinvestment in agriculture, particularly in developing countries, which has ultimately reduced their production capacity and turned a whole number of countries, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, into net food importers. And in the context of the high prices, then, of course, their situation became serious.
So there are several things we need to define. What is a commodity? And I've never really understood. I mean, this is a trade term, and I've never really understood what a commodity is. What is it?
A product that's traded, sold, and produced by a variety of different companies and countries.
Like what?
A commodity like corn or a commodity like soy.
Or cocoa.
Or wood. Or oil.
Or coffee.
These basic products that can be bought and sold in the market.
Yeah, but that's just how it's always been. I mean, it's just food, isn't it? Really?
Yes, it's food.
But it becomes a commodity, I think, when corporations move into poor countries and they have to give up their land to grow things like coffee or cocoa for the first world or developed world, while the developing world... I mean, I know when I wrote my book, If You Love This Planet, in 1992, which has just been revised, I read about companies moving into Central America, moving the peasants off their land where they had a subsistence living and growing flowers. And the peasants were kind of starving in the roads beside the flowers as the corporations, imported flowers into New York in the middle of winter. And every time I see these flowers in New York at all the, grocery shops, it makes me feel like vomiting because I know that it's because, and, these roses and everything, of course, they're all pesticided, but that's very much beside the point. It's land that's really been stolen, isn't it? And I suppose you could call flowers a commodity.
Yes, you could. I mean, I think commodity is where we're seeing in a way that you're describing it, commodification of our culture and our society, so that, even people have become commodities in this global market that we're in, including in the flower example.
Well, then, who decides what is a commodity or not? It's obviously the international trading community, the corporations. I mean, it's like the Pentagon that people are sort of, if people are killed in a nuclear war, it's collateral damage. I mean, in that sense, too, people are just commodities to the weapons in a way. I mean, I don't know if that's a good example, but I hate this corporate language, commodities.
And we all
tend to fall into the language. It's euphemisms, like we had to destroy the village to save it sort of stuff.
Right.
And it depersonalizes what is actually happening to people and the environment and the ecology and the world, as if, it's sort of like the language doctors use. We can stand over a patient's bed and talk about their diagnosis in a language they have no idea what it is. And they can die totally ignorant because we hide behind our language.
That's right.
Well, I think that's what the corporate world is doing. It's kind of wicked in a way because people don't understand. So let's talk about then why deregulation and free trade and all that rhubarb, if you'll excuse me. How has that impacted, the developing world? What does it mean, and how did it start in the World Trade Organization and all of that stuff, Alexandra?
Well, you know, it really goes back to, in thinking about the global situation, it goes back to definitely the 80s, where you saw this pressure from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund on developing country governments to, again, to deregulate, to liberalize their economies, to open up for investment, foreign investment.
Well, what does deregulate mean to those countries? What is deregulation?
Well, for example, in the area of agriculture, countries dismantled some key programs, that domestic programs that they had in agriculture. They had different cooperative schemes. They had subsidies to support their farmers.
Yeah.
They had rural extension programs. They had a variety of different programs that were then cut.
Why?
Because the idea was the less government and the more markets, the better off countries would be and the better off farmers would be. But that hasn't panned out.
But whose idea was that? It wasn't the countries, was it?
No. Well, it was pressure coming, largely from the World Bank and the IMF, and of course with heavy control from the G8 countries, from the United States and from the European Union, largely directing the global agricultural market to benefit agribusiness and new markets for agribusiness around the world. And this was then entrenched with the World Trade Organization in 1995 and with the Agreement on Agriculture, and then, of course, regional trade agreements that then followed suit. So there has been this very long-term process of countries cutting back on their domestic programs, setting up so-called free trade zones where corporations are not taxed when they move into the countries to invest.
That's a free trade zone where corporations are not taxed. Is that a definition of a free trade zone?
That isn't an exact definition of a free trade zone. So I can look that up and get the exact definition for you if you'd like, but that's a key component of it, yes, where corporations basically are tax-free and have very little requirements on them in when they go and set up in a country.
Go on.
There has been this pressure coming and that was entrenched with the trade negotiations, but also countries then removing their tariff barriers, again, those forms of taxation that would, their ability to block other countries from dumping their products onto their markets, from blocking import surges in times of food insecurity or in times of food crisis. And this has meant that countries are at a huge disadvantage in our current agricultural system. And have been struggling basically to try and compete in a system that basically doesn't allow them to do so.
Well, what do you mean food dumping and food surges? Who would do the dumping and the surges?
Well, dumping, for example, dumping is exporting it below the cost of production. And we've seen a lot of this in the North American context with NAFTA, where as Mexico dismantled its tariff.
It's tariffs, preventing,
On corn and on beans, they saw this incredible flood of overproduced U.S. corn into their markets. And the impact of that was that their farmers were unable to compete. They were pushed off the land and, you saw over 2 million small-scale farmers basically lose their livelihoods in a 15-year period. And many of those former farmers are now working in the United States and in some cases in the agricultural sector. So it's this huge irony that has occurred. But dumping is exporting it below the cost of production. And the U.S. has been a major player.
Why would they want to do that? They'd lose money.
Well, why would Mexico want to do that?
No, why would the corporations in America want to export food at below you know, production costs? They wouldn't make any money.
They're able to make a lot of money because the corporations, it's the small farmers who are losing, who are basically producing at a higher cost than what they actually receive.
Oh.
You see, they're the ones not receiving a fair price for their product.
Oh.
And the corporations are then able, they've basically consolidated their ownership of agricultural markets. You know, Cargill's a perfect example. It owns much of the production and distribution now.
Of what?
Of corn, for example, in the United States, Canada, and in Mexico.
Really?
So you see this incredible consolidation of agribusiness's power in a variety of aspects of both supply and distribution and retail as well. And that really squeezes out small farmers and also puts consumers at a disadvantage because they can't control, of course, the prices as they fluctuate. And we've certainly seen in the post-NAFTA period that, for example, the price of tortillas has gone up exponentially.
NAFTA is the North American Free Trade Agreement. So that Mexico was persuaded to sign that, and Canada. And I remember rushing backwards and forwards across Canada saying, don't sign the North American Free Trade Agreement. You'll lose your free medical care system. You'll lose everything. You'll become annexed to the United States. And part of that was for poor old Mexico, was it, to drop its tariffs so it could be flooded with corn from America? I mean, seems to me, and I know that I wrote about WTO, World Trade Organization, when it was happening in the early 90s and 80s, but it's a takeover. It's really a takeover of the world by these almighty corporations who have been able to persuade the Congress and buy out the Congress and the President, because I know that it was Clinton who brought in the North American Free Trade Agreement. I don't understand why countries like Mexico or Canada would go along with such a nefarious proposal. Is it because their politicians are too dumb to understand? Is it because they're bribed and bought out? What is it?
Well, I think there are a few things. And just to clarify, Mexico, by the way, was not coerced.
No.
Into cutting its domestic programs and opening up its borders. Mexico did that voluntarily. In fact, they cut many of their tariffs ahead of time, ahead of schedule, because they wanted to show their willingness to trade with the United States. So that kind of leads to a different argument. And I think that part of the issue is this, this long-term belief in a particular ideology that somehow markets will correct themselves. And that consumers will somehow correct the markets based on their buying choices.
That's rhubarb.
That's still a mythology that exists in the United States. It's clearly rubbish, and I think it's obviously in this food crisis, it doesn't ring true. One can feel that shift in the political wind, so to speak, where, you know, it's very hard now to defend this system that we have in place as working. It isn't working.
What, free trade, free enterprise, capitalism?
The whole free trade agenda. And it shows in the fact that the World Trade Organization negotiations have been absolutely stalled. They've been stalled for some time. And I think it's indicative of the fact that developing countries, when they signed into the agreement on agriculture, thought they would be gaining access to new markets.
How do you mean? What did Mexico think it would gain? Surely it didn't think it would gain anything from the United States, did it? And if it thought that, it must have been incredibly naive.
Well, I think that is exactly what was sold to the, not just Mexico, but the African countries as well, that they would have markets to the European Union, that they would be able to sell their products, that they would be able to have, they would at the end of the day have more economic wealth, and that this would lead to new investments and new infrastructure and, ultimately a better social well-being. And, you know, it just hasn't happened that way. And as you mentioned, of course, you're right to say that agribusiness groups did, in fact, help write the agreement on, on agriculture.
They wrote it.
U.S. for business. They largely wrote it. And
in the green room,
they wrote it in their favor.
In the green room negotiations,
that's right.
The WTO, World Trade Organization, was really a collection of multinational corporations, mostly from the States, but also, you know, Europe. And
yes.
It was run by the lawyers of the corporations, and they blocked out and prevented any NGOs, non-government organizations, churches, and developing countries from participating. And it was a green room negotiation, wasn't it? It was all
That's
worked
correct.
Out in a green room.
That's correct. And this undemocratic process has actually contributed to why the negotiations have been been stalled, because countries want to say in what's happening to their, you know, into their futures. And
fancy that.
You know, clearly the other thing that's come out of all of this is that the EU and the US were, you know, haven't eliminated their subsidies and their own support. So on the one hand, countries have been encouraged, as I mentioned, you know, not just through the WTO, but you know, through the World Bank and the IMF to reduce support for their own agriculture and food industries.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the U.S. and the EU have maintained their very strong support for their industries and can and have dominated the world food market.
Yeah, it's absolutely wicked, isn't it? It's wicked. I can't.
Yes, it is.
People starving.
And the other thing that's happened is the European Union and the U.S. have, over time, reduced their support to agriculture in overseas development assistance. So you've seen this, this huge drop in support for agriculture over the last 25 years. Now, of course, that's shifting. All of a sudden, there's much more attention now being paid to the importance of agriculture, the agricultural sector, and I think a recognition that obviously food. This is a major crisis that we're looking at now, and it sets the stage for the land acquisitions, not just food, but energy and access to resources, and I think it's a sad development, frankly, because, you know, ultimately the real crisis is the crisis in production, you know, in the fact that we have a model of production that is, that is highly intensive. Energy intensive, that creates slave, or that is predicated on slave labor. That really creates this incredible gap between the haves and the have-nots. And we are in this very hard to believe, really, this post-colonial period where land is of the utmost importance, and all of the struggle is centering around that. And the other thing that's happening, of course, is that those countries that are resource scarce are looking to find ways to bolster their food security, their energy, and their well-being in the future. And so there's this clear awareness that that those countries who can pay will somehow have a better chance, perhaps, than those countries who can't. And I think it's a dangerous moment.
I'm interviewing Alexandra Spieldop, the Director of the Trade and Global Governance Program at the Institute of Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Now, who, Alexandra, was the man at the University of Chicago who developed all these free trade policy ideas, and that the market will look after itself, and that the IMF and World Bank should cut support and deregulate any countries it goes into, otherwise they won't get any money lent to them. Who was that man? Do you remember?
No, sorry, I'm not remembering names right now.
Yeah, well, I'm not either. He was a doyen of the free market enterprise. But
David Ricardo?
No.
No, okay.
But I, in my book I've got that's just come out again, If You Love This Planet, it's interesting that the corporations, after the end of the First World War, learned how to use propaganda mechanisms from the First World War, and they found out that they couldn't sell stuff to Americans because it was good, like Pears soap, or, you know, it washed your body better, and the like. The way you could sell stuff to Americans, and I suppose I say stuff consciously, was to use Americanism. patriotism, and they've worked out two formulas, which you can see underlie all the discussions we're having today in a funny way. The first one was free enterprise equals freedom, right, equals democracy, equals family, equals Christianity, equals nationalism, equals God. And isn't that how many of the Republicans talk in the Congress today? Really? Whereas the equal and opposite formula they devised went like this: egalitarianism equals equality, equals government interference, equals socialism, equals unions, equals communism, equals Satan. I'll just read a paragraph. Just watch TV carefully for one night and you'll understand what I mean. A big, tough, hairy guy hefts a can of beer, the ad implying that all red-blooded Americans drink this brand of beer. The scene fades with patriotic music in the background. There may even be a suggestion of a US flag waving in the background. Advertisements often imply that freedom and democracy are God-given, that the family is a fundamental unit of American society, and that all is well with the world if you buy the products in the ads. Now, that's simplistic, but it's sort of basic, and I've got lots of references to that. But let's get on, Alexandra Spieldock, to what is happening in the world. First of all, let's address water, and that's very prominent in your article and what you talk about. Why is water, well, we know why it's important, because we can't live without water, but why is it becoming scarcer? What is actually happening?
Well, I think there are a variety of things that are happening. I mean, I clearly, the argument that I make is that, that intensive agricultural production, industrial agricultural production, is actually contributing to depletion of resources and requires huge amounts of irrigated water for large-scale plantation kind of production, and that this ultimately is unsustainable and is siphoning water that could be used in a much more sustainable manner and to support small-scale production, much more sustainable methods of production, as well as just basic needs like drinking water being siphoned away from communities, again, to support the amount of water for corn plantations, for example, and soy, is pretty incredible. And it's not just those crops. I mean, it's also for large-scale dairy production. It's for large-scale animal factories. And consequently, another impact of industrial agriculture is also the pollution of water. And all kinds of pesticides and other gases that are going into our environment and having ultimately a negative impact on people and on the land.
Yeah, the degradation of water. And then, of course, the corporations who are growing all this stuff all over the country. And I remember during the Reagan era, the takeover of family farms, particularly in the Midwest, and farmers by corporations and farmers hanging themselves in their barns because they were so depressed and because they were becoming bankrupt and couldn't support their families. But this has gone on and on now, hasn't it? And so the corporations themselves in the developing world are contributing to water scarcity. I've got a thing here which says meat requires 10 times more water per calorie than plants. Biofuels are one of the most thirsty products on the planet. It takes 9,100 litres of water to grow the soya for 1 litre of biodiesel and up to 4,000 litres for corn to be transformed into biodiesel. And the chief of Nestle says, under present conditions and with the way water is being managed, we'll run out of water long before we run out of fuel. But that's...
Well,
I don't know about that. but the other thing, of course, is global warming, and the glaciers are drying up, particularly in the Himalayas, which water billions of people, and they're drying up all over the world, and they supply the rivers and the Ganges and the Yellow River and the like that upon which billions live. So that's a multiplying factor, right?
Yes, That is a multiplying factor, and you know, again, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, I think all of these crises are interlinked, and water is very much at the center. I mean, you know, it's interesting. Water hasn't yet gotten the international attention
really
that I think that it deserves, and I do believe that we will see in this coming period. I mean, even in the next couple of years. More and more media reports on this and more research on this. Certainly in the U.S., we're seeing incredible drought and crisis at the national level or, you know, between the states where you have, you know, counties like the central part of California just, you know, experiencing, which is the industrial agricultural part of the state, which really doesn't have enough water to support that kind of production. And water's been, you know, pumped into that region.
From the Colorado.
And it's unsustainable. So, you know, these are the debates that are coming up. They're very real for the farmers, both large and small, and ultimately will shift the direction that, you know, that we will end up going in. You asked for some statistics, I think, on water earlier, and something like over 1 billion people don't even have access to safe drinking water in the world. And over, you know, it's like 2.5 billion don't have water just for basic sanitation. So it's not small numbers. And, you know, agriculture is contributing, you know, in a linked way. It's contributing not only to climate change, and, you know, the statistics are still being kind of sorted out because there's been less analysis on agriculture in relation to climate, but that's changing.
Corporate agriculture.
Corporate agriculture, you know, up to 30%. Contribution of agriculture to greenhouse gas emissions because of
30%.
When you up to 30% if you include land use, transportation, packaging and processing, you know, you start to see the numbers really, really go up again, you know, related to industrialized farming. And then of course, irrigated agriculture, accounts for almost 70% of the amount of water, you know, that's withdrawn, so to speak, for human, you know, for human consumption.
In the United States or globally?
Globally. 70%. From rivers and lakes. Yes, 70%.
Well, that was probably okay when we all grew our own food in our own plots or there were small family farms, but I'm sure, but now it's changed. I mean, I live in a small fishing village on the east coast of New South Wales in Australia. I tell you, it hasn't rained for ages and ages. It's so dry. And I look out, it's beautiful weather and the birds are on stuff. But I think, is it ever going to rain again? It's that sort of kind of desperate feeling.
And of course, all eyes are on Australia. I mean, you know, a lot of the challenges with the, you know, with the food shortages, particularly looking at wheat, you know, came out of the fact that Australia was a large supplier to the world market. And again, this is another indication that the free trade market, so to speak, isn't working. It doesn't work in this mode that we're in. It never did work.
No.
It never did work, but it's certainly clear that it doesn't work now because, you know, when countries, the stocks are, when they lose their supply, and they're no longer trading in the global market. Net food importing countries go hungry, and that's exactly what has happened. And we had over 30 riots around the world, in you know, both small, medium, or in small, medium, and large countries, including China. Governments were forced to take matters into their own hands. They couldn't leave their food security situation up to the global market, or they would be lynched. They would be killed. You know, Haiti is a great example of what happens when the population gets to that point of just being so hungry and desperate. They overthrow the government. And, you know, it's, food is non-negotiable.
That's what happened in Madagascar, too, isn't it? Where
Madagascar as well.
Where Daewoo, the huge South Korean food corporation, was going to take over half of Madagascar.
That's right. Half of Madagascar's arable land.
And pay no taxes.
Without the population knowing about it, without taxation, without any kind of, you know, controls on the actual the type of investment or the ways in which the investment would feed back into the economy. The lease was a 99-year lease.
Oh, yes.
And, as soon as the public got wind of this, it was over. I mean, it's ridiculous. And that's part of what is so shocking about these land leases. A, it's the size of the leases, you know, where you have, largely 100,000 or so hectares, per land deal, and it goes higher. But you also have, in many cases, I think the lowest amount I've seen is 25-year lease, going all the way up to 99 years, and very, in countries that are already quite unstable and in great need. And the deals, without proper controls on investment, it's very hard to see how they will contribute to the overall well-being of the economies,
Well,
and particularly in countries that are already importing food. I mean, some of these countries are already recipients of food aid in the World Food Program. And
which ones?
Are also,
which ones? Name them, Alexandra.
Okay, and let me find the list.
Ethiopia.
Ethiopia is
Ghana.
One. Ghana.
And then we need to name the countries who are going to who are presently in the process of taking over these countries.
Right. So we have Cambodia is a country that's a recipient and also being targeted for investment. Niger.
Yeah.
Tanzania, Ethiopia, Burma.
Yeah.
These are all countries that have completed or have projected land deals, but they're also beneficiaries of aid from the World Food Program.
Mozambique,
probably.
Yeah.
I don't have that as one of my on my list in front of me, but probably.
Mm.
And so you see this, this very kind of neo-colonial thing happening, where countries are really in a very strange, and I mean it's almost like some kind of, I don't know how to describe it.
Stealing.
It just makes so little sense. It's stealing.
It's stealing. But
even the FAO has referred to it as a neo-colonial.
What's FAO?
Era. I'm sorry, the Food and Agricultural Organization.
It's not neo-colonial. It's pure colonialism. That's
what it's pure colonial. It's extended colonialism.
And what are the countries who are taking over these land grabs and paying nothing, almost nothing for them?
This is interesting because in the early part of our conversation, we talked about the EU and the United States kind of dominating global markets.
Yeah.
And, I would argue that's still largely the case. But in fact, what is so interesting about these land deals is that it's not just a north-south thing. I mean, certainly there is investment coming from the EU and the U.S., but a lot of it is being led by, those countries that lack resources and are looking to bolster their food security and energy security
moving
forward.
They lack fertile land. That's what they lack.
They lack fertile land. They lack water.
Yep.
Water being, again, the key component, or even, large tracts of land. So we're looking at countries like Bahrain and Saudi Arabia being a major investor. United Arab Emirates.
Qatar,
Kuwait, Oman, they're all investing heavily. And then, of course, we've seen the example with South Korea in Madagascar and China as well in many countries in Africa, and not just for food, but also China being a big investor in biofuels.
And India as well.
India as well. They've developed a whole consortium of investors, and they're looking into Africa, but they also, as I understand it, have just they have already started negotiating some deals or are even in the process of completing some deals in Latin America. Paraguay is another target for some of this investment. And you've mentioned some of the countries in Africa that are key countries, Ethiopia, Sudan, Madagascar, Zimbabwe, but also Pakistan. Pakistan is another host country for some of this investment. And this is the thing. It's also wrapped up in this instability that we have vis-a-vis geopolitical relationships as well, and so-called security that you referred to earlier. But Pakistan, as I understand it, has some of the most lax laws on investors. I mean, no requirements, no performance requirements, no taxation, 99-year lease. You know, come in and invest, and we'll see how real some of these deals end up being, because I think that there have been a lot of reports. Not all the deals have gone through. There have even been, you know, journalists like yourself who've tried to delve deeper or gone to visit the countries and to try and figure out, you know, the details of some of these deals. And there's still a lot that's unclear. But we do know that they're growing at a really rapid pace. There was a report from a major think tank here, a fairly conservative think tank here, that estimates that since 2006, that 20 million hectares of land have been sold in approximately 50 deals, mainly in Africa. So it's a lot of land that's up for grab, basically. And will ultimately, I think, may or may not even reach a point of completion, depending on where civil society fits into the discussions and to what degree the investment will actually bring any kind of good to the country.
What gets me is that it's happening behind closed doors virtually. I mean, I read very widely. I read the New York Times every day, Washington Post, Huffington Post, what it is, and the papers in Australia and the like. I didn't know about this till I came upon you and your writings. I had no idea. In other words, little is being discussed as these huge robberies of people's lands are taking place. And you know, George Soros and other Rothschilds and other huge investors are saying this is the latest thing. Where, you know, we're buying land now to grow food, which I wouldn't have thought. I thought Soros had a bit of a moral conscience, but I'm wondering about it now. And the other thing is biofuels. I mean, if ever there was a waste of energy and pure supposition that biofuels can replace oil, you need huge amounts of oil and oil products and fertilizers and the like to grow biofuels. And in the end, you get out less energy, far less, I think 2.5 times less, I'm not sure, than the energy you put into growing the things. And it's feeding cars, not people. And in that sense, it's wicked. And I speak now as a physician. Where on earth is the world going? And I know that, you know, Cargill, and what's the big food corporation that runs the Lira program, Jim Lira or McNeil, and advertises the food basket of the world, and one of their directors is currently in jail. Can you remember that?
Is this Monsanto you're talking about?
No, it's not Monsanto. No, it's another.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know who's sponsoring the McNeil Lira show, but I know that Monsanto is also using that kind of rhetoric.
Yeah.
And Cargill, I mean, they're major. That's pretty much their standard line.
Food basket for the world, but and also the farmers in Iowa, you know, the corn farmers, those lovely people growing corn. Well, they're now growing it for cars and making a lot of money, because suddenly many of the people in Congress see there's a shortage of oil coming up. We've already reached peak oil and we're down on the other side of the slope. And they, in their scientific illiteracy, think that this will be one of the answers. So the money's pouring out into farms and corporations to make biofuel. And then, of course, as you extend to other countries like Malaysia and the like, chopping down forests to grow biofuel crops, palm oil, and what's the other one? Jatropha,
yeah. Well, you know, the thing that I just to say one thing about that, you know, it is it totally. I agree with the fact that it's unsustainable, but I don't completely agree that that U.S. farmers are getting rich off of biofuels. You know, in fact, agribusinesses is continuing to get. It's continuing to make its profits on whatever it is. It's biofuels today. I mean, then that's the argument. You know, it may be cocoa one day or coffee one day, and then it's biofuels the next. Mm. It's the same model. It's the same approach to markets, then that in itself is unsustainable. But in fact, what's happened to even those small farmers who briefly were making some money for the first time in decades, you know, because for decades the price of corn was so low, they went out, and these are the suicides you're talking about. You know, farmers not being able to get a fair price for their for their crop. You know, going out of business in droves. We've lost so many. In fact, you know, small scale agriculture is an incredibly small percentage in the U.S. now. It's largely industrial.
It's
those farmers who are even able to, and small and medium, able to make a small profit, are now even seeing that diminishing because the cost of input is that much higher. So as you were saying, the fertilizers, you know, and water and tractors and all of this has actually gone up. And so we've seen no real gain. And as you say, it's not a sustainable sustainable way to produce. It has nothing to do with energy security, and that continues to be much of the rhetoric that is used, particularly by the United States. And that's not to say that there can't be some use for biofuels at a very local level for local consumption that is not based on monocropping, but based on, switchgrass and agroforestry and sustainable methods. But that's not at all what we're seeing in the U.S. And it's, you know, whatever promise there might have been has gone right out the window, in my view.
Yes, and to get back to another subject that was brought up, water, you know what? We had the most ghastly fires last summer in Victoria, where it was literally like a nuclear holocaust, the firestorm, fires jumping 10 miles and burning houses just spontaneously igniting. Yeah. Now it's happening in Greece.
It's terrible.
Yeah, now it's happening in Greece. You see, as it gets drier and as it gets hotter, more and more fires begin, either started by humans or lightning or whatever, and that adds millions of tons of CO2 to an already overloaded atmosphere, global warming atmosphere. So global warming increases, it gets even drier, there's less rain and more fires. It's like the human body, where there are sort of feedback mechanisms that, you know, if you have a patient with heart failure and they're not doing too well, the liver starts to fail, and then the lungs get full of fluid, and it's a feedback ongoing mechanism. And I see the earth kind of like a patient, a human patient, where, well, what I guess I'm raving on here, Alexandra, but
no, it is very disturbing. And then you have, you know, Monsanto as an example of an organization that's sort of, you know, there's new rhetoric now about, you know, getting more food out of a raindrop.
What?
You know, so if we, I don't have the exact line. I can even send it to you, and maybe you can use
it.
Sounds
like a
song
separately. From Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, because, of course, whatever, all we have to do is just be more innovative. And all we need now is biotechnology and new innovations to deal with this crisis. And that is, in fact, much of the rhetoric that's also going along with, on the one hand, this very positive, I think, attention to agriculture and to the fact that more investment is needed. I actually think that is fantastic, and it's, you know, there's this convergence of the international institutions and governments and even civil society groups that recognize this. But on the other hand, there's this growing chasm between, again, this kind of those who partake in this neoliberal understanding of agriculture and, you know, the fact that we need to produce more, create new markets. We need more intensive agriculture, and then we need new technologies to deal with all the fallout that happens when we, you know, when we produce in an intensive way. And those who are calling for more local, organic, sustainable practices, and you know, the two are at odds. And unfortunately, from the U.S., you know, there's a lot of ground being made and space being made to support the biotech industry.
Well,
looking for new markets, you know.
As you look down the slippery slope to the future, as we run out of oil, and it's going to shortly become more and more and more expensive, as it's more expensive to extract from the ground, and there are fewer and fewer oil deposits around the world. That's going to impact agriculture enormously. I mean, our whole economy, our whole societies, certainly in the developed world, depend upon oil. Plastics, pesticides, you know, transportation, food, the whole thing. And so sooner than later, probably, these huge corporate monoliths who put out this propaganda, and it is propaganda, will be brought to their knees, maybe not soon enough, but that local communities are going to have to start getting together and producing their own food and working out their own water supply and the like. Would you like to comment on that, Alexandra?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that, you know, you're describing, you know, what is ultimately a land struggle.
Mm.
And I think the, you know, that is the core of what we're what we're dealing with.
Yeah.
We're dealing with you know, we're dealing with land availability or the lack thereof.
Yeah.
We're dealing with growing populations.
Yep.
And so, you know, you talked about Ethiopia. You know, Ethiopia is expected to more than double.
Oh my God.
By 2050, Madagascar is expected to triple.
Oh.
You know, so you know, these are major challenges, and I think the land struggle will be at the heart of all of this. And, you know, again, in terms of land, 75% of people in you know, in Africa and Asia are basically making a living on the land in agriculture in the rural sector and from marginal land.
Mm, mm.
And so, you know, what are we going to do with these people when we kick them off the land? In a way, I think it can't happen, because I think what we'll see is a incredible violence that will grow, more conflict and more vulnerable situations. And and it's why I said in the beginning, I do believe this is an historic moment, not to just be doom and gloom. I mean, we have some real choices to make, and it doesn't have to be this way. You know, and I think that until we really kind of acknowledge this development problem that we're really in, we're going to see it get a lot worse. But if we can begin to come together with some more comprehensive solutions that, again, would support local food systems, local produce, smallholder producers who, in this whole land crisis, ultimately lack bargaining power, they lack access to markets and information, they lack land rights, particularly women, who are the majority of the world's farmers, by the way, and almost get no say in the international discussions.
That's
that are
right,
happening.
They do most of the work.
They do most of the work, and yet, you know, they don't have formal legal rights.
Oh.
And so, you know, if we can kind of get to the point where we're honest about what, you know, the need for the right to information, for democratic processes to, you know, to support more sustainable methods. You know, there is no reason why investment, global investment, can't go in that direction. And, you know, just to end with, I mean, at least on that point, with one more note, there was a study that was done. I don't know if you heard about it. It was called the International Assessment for Agriculture, Science, Technology, and Development.
Mm.
And this study was signed by 58 governments. The U.S. so far doesn't recognize it. It was an effort of the international institutions as well. It included 400 contributors from science, academia, civil society, private sector, and across the board, what they said was that it's not so much more supply that's needed or more production, It's sustainable practices that science and technology need to support small-scale farming and local knowledge and biodiversity. And that, these are the things that are critical when we kind of look at what solutions need to be prioritized, as well as healthy food, because we're also looking at food safety issues that have emerged. And I take that study very seriously, because it's not just you know, the civil society organization, the nonprofit organization that will get dismissed, you know, by the more conservative opinions. This comes out of a joint process over 4 years of a whole mix of groups, including governments, including the EU, that acknowledge that we're on the wrong path, and that we've got to find ways to safeguard our land, to safeguard our water, to safeguard our farmers and our people, and nothing short of that is going to lead to resolving these crises.
Well, I think that's a wonderful summary, Alexandra. And here we end. We've run out of time. I think it's been a most provocative, thoughtful, thought-inducing interview, and I thank you kindly for being interviewed on If You Love This Planet.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. My guest today was Alexandra Spieldock, the Director of the Trade and Global Governance Program at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis and Minnesota. For more information on the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, go to their website, www.iatp.org. www.iatp.org. This is Helen Caldicott, and I'm going to quote from my new book, If You Love This Planet. To quote Thomas Jefferson, the care of human life and happiness and not their destruction is the first and only legitimate object of good government. Or as Dwight D. Eisenhower put it, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. International aid is but a band-aid on the wounds of third world suffering. The people there are not just malnourished and deprived because of overpopulation, inadequate distribution of money, lack of education, or bad land management. They're poor and starving because financial powers in the developed world exploit them to satisfy their own greed and continuing affluence. Two major dynamics occurring globally are having and will continue to have severe and lasting repercussions on the developing world. One is a huge foreign debt incurred by the developing world, which increased from $618 billion in 1980 to $3.15 trillion in 2006, according to figures published by the International Monetary Fund. The IMF predicted that the external debt of this group of countries comprising 45 member states would continue to grow throughout 2007 to more than $3.35 trillion. The other dynamic is a dangerous set of negotiations known as free trade agreements that took place in the organization called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, which was replaced in 1994 by the World Trade Organization, WTO. Thanks for listening once again, and we'll talk with you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.